Well, hello, everybody. Sorry to interrupt the flow of the meeting. I just want to say thank you to all of you who are here. Some of you have been serving on our Export Council for quite some time. Some of you are here as new additions, but all of you have been extraordinarily successful in your various fields, and it gives us an enormous opportunity to hear from you in very concrete terms about how we can advance not just America's export agenda, but how we can build the kind of economic future that we want for our kids and our grandkids. For the last 51 months, we have created jobs here in the United States, 9.4 million jobs in all. But we're going to have to create more. And one of the best ways to do it is to boost American manufacturing and American exports. That's why, since I came into office, we have been promoting American products and businesses when I travel overseas. It's why we created the President's Export Council in 2010. There are some of the most iconic companies in the world, Boeing being an example, Xerox being another one. And with your help, exports have driven one-third of the economic growth in our recovery and now support over 11 million U.S. jobs. Last year, we exported $2.3 trillion in goods and services, which was an all-time high. And business executives around the globe say that the United States is the best place to locate, the best place to invest, and the best place to hire. And that's the first time that they've said that, that we are number one when it comes to their desirable location to invest. This is the first time they've said that in over a decade. So the Made in America brand is stronger than ever. And as we saw yesterday at the first White House Maker Fair, I was out there watching these 22-year-olds coming up with incredible things. It is going to be a remarkable future that we have to look ahead to, because in many ways, manufacturing is becoming easier. Some of the barriers to entry are lowering. It gives inventors and entrepreneurs the opportunity to create new products and services in ways that we can't even imagine. And we want to make sure that all those trends accelerate here in the United States. So this is a moment of opportunity. We've got a chance to extend our competitive advantage in the world. That's what this meeting is about. One thing I want to focus on today is opening up even more new markets to Made in America products. We're working very hard to finalize trade agreements with our partners in Europe and in Asia that will make us the center of a free trade hub covering two-thirds of the world economy. And Mr. Michael Froman has been putting in a lot of miles trying to make sure that that happens. And I know he's consulted with some of you, not just big companies, but a lot of small and medium-sized businesses who have enormous opportunities if we're able to open up these markets, and oftentimes are the ones that have the hardest time navigating through some of the barriers that are out there. I especially want to increase trade and investment in the region, and this is going to be one of the issues we discuss in August. There has been some explosive growth in certain parts of the world where we're just not doing enough. Africa is being a prime example. You've got 6 of the 10 fastest-growing economies in Africa. A young population that is growing rapidly. Some of these economies are doing very, very well, but we're not penetrating those markets as well as we should have. And I think we've got a great opportunity in August with an Africa Leaders Summit that's going to be taking place for us to talk about trade and commerce, because that's really what that continent is interested in. They're not interested in aid as much as they are trade, development, and partnering with the private sector. And as your businesses know well, when we export products overseas, we're creating jobs and opportunities here at home. That's the focus here today and every day of my presidency. How do we create thriving businesses that are also able to create great jobs that allow people not just to stay in the middle class, but to work their way into the middle class if they work hard and take responsibility. And all of you have done that. This council is doing great work. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Jay to hear about some of the ideas that you've come up with and how we can help advance this this agenda.
Well, again, thank you for your attendance. It it energizes us and reminds us of the importance of our work. And we appreciate your comments about our engagement. I think we are going to send you a record 9 letters coming out of this meeting. We discussed them, and there are a couple of themes, one of which is around this manufacturing and technology innovation and its enablement. And we've had some discussion that Jeff and Penny have led before you came here that reminds us of the importance of that. And I think we had sort of held off discussing that until you came here because of your leadership, personal leadership there. And I think one of the letters you're going to get is from Vanessa, our small business startup star from Oregon, who is talking about finding new ways to finance small businesses, often technology-based, and its importance for us to focus on that issue. And so I think we were hoping maybe you'd talk a little bit about, elaborate a little bit on what you said right. about enabling small businesses not only to export but just to become a bigger part of our economy and the role of manufacturing and technology innovation. We're delighted to hear of that emphasis because it's at the heart of what a lot of us do around here.
Well, first of all, I just want to know how much Schultz paid you to position the Starbucks.
Yeah, it was.
I'm sure Howard's catching that on television. Right now. They did a good thing with the announcing a scholarship program with
yes.
Arizona State, which I think is worth companies looking at. I think what I'd like to do is begin with some of this technology and innovation, because as I said yesterday, we have this amazing collection of folks. Over the last couple of days, we've been talking about what do things like 3D printing and the revolution in making stuff that initially was just using software for data and information, and now suddenly it's starting to move into the three-dimensional space and is still in its infancy. It's still where the Internet probably was 25, 30 years ago, but there are enormous opportunities there. And it was a reminder when you see some young person who invented an incubator that's $200 and is already saving 60,000 lives of preemie babies around the world, high school kids who are develop a sports car that gets 100 miles a gallon as part of their class project. It just gives you a sense of why it is that we've been an economic superpower in the past and why we have to maintain that. So one person that I thought would be great to comment on this is Marilyn Hewson from Lockheed Martin, obviously one of our greatest innovators, and occupies a unique section position in our manufacturing sector. So I know this is something that folks have been thinking about. Let's turn to Marilyn and hear what the conversation has yielded so far.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. You know, as an advanced technology company like Lockheed Martin, investing in research and development is absolutely critical to our business. It's critical to growth. It's critical to sustaining the business. And as you said, it's what generates jobs throughout the supply chain. Over 60% of our business goes out into the supply chain to small and medium-sized businesses. So what we invest in flows all the way through. We are investing in a lot of emerging technologies as well as current technologies, from robotics to quantum computing to hypersonic aircraft that can fly Mach 6. So our engineers and scientists are working on that every day. But to your point, the manufacturing process is another area that we're investing in. This additive manufacturing or 3D printing that you brought up, and I know you spent some time on it here, but also in Pittsburgh this week, and there's a lot of excitement around it. What's exciting to us at Lockheed Martin is the ability to take it to large-scale manufacturing environments and do complex parts. And we are doing some of that, and we're finding that relative to traditional manufacturing and design, it's reducing the cost about 80%, and it's getting the parts faster. So we have it today. We've got parts, titanium parts, on the NASA Juno spacecraft that's on its way now to Jupiter. And it's exciting that we were yielding those very results from 3D printing of those parts. I think the more that we can invest as a company and the companies around this table in research and development, in manufacturing processes, that's what's going to generate the jobs for us in the U.S., and that's what's going to allow us to take those to other markets. And this body is about export and trade, and in that exporting arena, if we can get those products to market faster through things like 3D printing, that's what's going to make a big difference for our companies.
That's great. And obviously, a big chunk of this is R&D investment by your company, but I think it's not just defense contractors that recognize the degree to which federal R&D and basic research ends up being critical in us maintaining that technological edge. And a lot of the folks that I saw out in that yard yesterday were MIT professors and Stanford professors, and they continually reminded me that all this neat stuff that they're coming up with that eventually have commercial applications start off in laboratories and in research facilities, because it's the nature of basic research that you don't know if it's going to pay off. And so it's oftentimes more difficult to justify. The days of the old Bell Labs where, if you had monopolies, you had enough money to go ahead and sink in a whole bunch of kooky stuff, those days are over. You guys got to watch your bottom lines a little more. So the federal government has to make sure that it's doing its job on that front. Good. As you mentioned, Vanessa, one of our small business stars, although I don't know how small it's going to stay since she's
exactly.
Since she's so good. Vanessa, you want to talk a little bit about, as the CEO of a startup, what role do you see in spurring innovation in the economy, and how does that link up with our export agenda? Because a lot of times folks figure if you're small or medium size, you're not thinking about overseas markets.
Yeah, no, that's not true. Coming from the green building market and the USGBC really pushing the green building standards, startups and entrepreneurial companies in that sector really have to look at innovative products around data and performance. How are we really affecting the environment when we build these buildings? And so as a small company, a startup, we actually received a commercialization grant from our state to partner up with our local university, Portland State University, to develop a rain lab, basically to simulate rainstorms all around the world so we could develop green roof technology around those types of storms and what cities are impacting so that we can help with their infrastructure issues around flooding. So that modeling allowed us to develop a tool where we can manufacture green roof technology for that particular city and the storms that are going to be coming over the next 2, 5, and 100 years. So what that does, it allows us, I think, to have innovative green manufacturing, for example, and as we continue to export, there are these same environmental green building standards and issues around the world. We want to be a leader in green and green building. And having that commercialization grant, working with the universities, develop these labs, get the performance data, will actually, I believe, be a leader and beat other countries around the world in this area, because quality is really important, how we manufacture quality to meet these standards, and we're positioning ourselves to do that.
That's great. Just one last area, and then maybe we can open it up a little bit. Obviously, one of the areas where we've been an incredible innovation leader has been in agricultural products, food processing. My home state company, ADM, is pretty good at that. So, Pat, although I think I hear a Coldplay.
That's for you.
It's not Putin's ring.
I've become an expert at hearing people's rings. You know? I'm pretty sure that was cool fun. Pat?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about technology a little bit with agriculture and food products. Sometimes, as you know, ADM is a big manufacturer of corn-based ethanol. Many people think of that as a first generation. But because of technology and technological innovation, we've taken it to much lower cost, lower energy usage, over higher sustainability, more waste products, and as also a result of market conditions and this innovation, what started sort of as a homegrown fuel, thinking about using it in the U.S., now we export, the industry does, up to 1 billion gallons a year. And because it's such a low-cost transportation fuel, other areas of the world are very much looking for our fuels as well. So it's become an export due to that technology and that innovation. And it's laid the platform for the advanced stages of technology to go to much more second- and third-generation fuels. On the food side of agriculture, innovation has led to a lot of, in our country, of course, we think about health and nutrition. And so health and wellness is a big effort of our R&D centers. And that is, of course, interested and being in, more interested in developing countries as well. So as the population grows, more use of protein, more stealth nutrition, so to speak. So to put protein, to put fibers, to put natural sweeteners, much more healthful products in everything not only that we might consume in this country, but is much larger demand and much higher growth rates, exports and internationally.
That's great. So while I'm going to put you back in charge, why don't we,
okay.
why don't we see if...
You know, I thought one thing that might be of interest to you that might lead to a broader discussion is Ginny on cross-data border flows. Sort of in a post-Snowden world, people are sort of wrapping themselves in the cloak of privacy to achieve protectionist goals. And Ginny made a sort of a compelling case, and it's going to embody itself in a letter to you. So Ginny Rometty, would you, of IBM, would you just make the president aware? I know it's your third time this morning making the speech.
I know anyone could give the speech now.
And I know Mike Froman's all over it, but it's...
He is, in both Secretary Pritzker and Ambassador Froman, you should know, have been very helpful in this already, because there have been a number of instances already pulled back as a result of the efforts of the administration. But it is this idea that in the post-Snowden world, as Jim described, one reaction is to keep data in your borders or don't let it flow across borders and say things that may seem sort of innocent about, well, let's keep all those servers right in this country. And in effect, what we often see is that that is, as Jim just described, under the veil of security and privacy, when in the end it's a form of protectionism and it's a form of really advocation by many local companies who would say, this would be great for my business. So I think it pertains not only to be able to sell globally, that isn't even it. It's really about operating, and even for their own economies it's not good, because many companies make money if you're in one European country to another European country, and or government services that you need that cross. We were talking about travel earlier, et cetera. So it's really not good any way you look at it, but you do see then this proliferation. And so we really do appreciate the administration's efforts here to bat these down, but of course, Ambassador Froman really getting them tied down well in the new trade agreements to recognize this form of digital trade is essential to not just operate, not just sell, but for governments to be efficient as well.
Well, we've been all over this from the get-go. Obviously, there have been enormous commercial implications to the Snowden disclosures, and as indicated, in some cases there have been legitimate concerns about privacy issues. Oftentimes, those dovetail with either purely commercial interests in these countries that are, as Jenny just said, looking to make sure it's their servers in their facilities with their nationals who are handling this data. In some cases, there are countries that have been for a long time uncomfortable with the openness of the Internet and have been using this as an excuse to see if they can balkanize the Internet and build their own platforms that they would have greater control over. In both cases, what we've said is, you've got legitimate concerns, we will be able to respond to them. Illegitimate concerns, we're going to challenge. And you're right that both TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and TTIP, the European trade agreement that we're working on, will have to have these kinds of an architecture that preserves fair and free trade within this realm. I would just add, while we're on this topic, that we're spending a lot of time thinking generally about big data, its implications for every aspect of the economy. How do we make sure that we have protected people's privacy and are mindful about potential abuses of big data, but also that we're taking advantage of opportunities. You know, the federal government has enormous stores of data. Most of your weather apps on your smartphone is because of government data that somebody figured out how to make easily accessible and commercialized. Healthcare is an area, for example, where the possibilities are endless for us as we learn more about the human genome. Our ability to potentially detect diseases, design drugs for specific diseases, individualize medicine so we know it's more effective, huge possibilities. But all that stuff has to be done in a way that preserves our privacy and our values. So John Podesta has been leading a group in consultation with a number of companies interested in this space, and we'll continue to report out because this is something that will be relevant internationally, and if we get it right, then it allows us to have other goods and services that we may be able to export as well. But other countries are not always as good about some of the IP behind this, and we've got to think it through.
You know, it's an adjacent point that we talked about earlier, and Scott, I'm headed toward you a little bit, is the use of technology and trade facilitation. You know, a more mundane use of technology, but one that is critically important to
logistics, to
making stuff. Yeah, you got it. No one likes to use that word. But maybe you could make a comment or two again on that for the president.
Well, just in general, I think that one thing we're seeing today is we're actually seeing small, medium-sized businesses show more interest in exporting. We've been working with the Commerce Department for a long time. Very small minority export. Today, I think with e-commerce particularly, you know, we're seeing huge demand out of the e-commerce customers to do it. They don't have the resources to handle the cumbersome procedures at customs and border. But I think that you know, the progress we're making, obviously in the trade facilitation agreement, we got to push hard to implement it quicker. I think the executive order on the single window simplifies things. We were excited about doing that. I think raising de minimis, and it's a battle for Ambassador Froman with some of the other countries, but that makes it much easier, I think, for these small businesses to do it. Mm-hmm. So the exciting thing right now is there's still not enough doing it. Most of them that do export go to one country, but the level of interest is growing tremendously.
That's good, and I think appreciate your work on that, Scott. And Robert, maybe XM was one that we spent a lot of time on. The fight's a little tougher than it's been in the past on the Hill, Mr. President, as you know.
Mr. President, I want to let you know you also receive a letter from the PEC that we fully support and endorse the 5-year reauthorization of the XM Bank and the cap moving to $160 billion. It's clear that the majority of businesses around the United States, as well as businesses around the globe, support the Ex-Im Bank of the United States. It is, one, it lends to small businesses. 90% of transactions went to small businesses from the U.S. Ex-Im Bank. Two, it earns money. Three, it creates jobs. And four, it increases our competitiveness. And without it would be literally unconscionable. And so we are fully supportive that this gets done by September 30th, and you'll receive our letter.
I assume that, Jim, you've been in contact with PRT and Cheney.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes. And with every congressman and senator I can find, we're helping. And, you know, I think one of the – Fred has morphed XM, and the argument is stronger now because of the small business engagement that you've achieved with some of your new – structured products and initiatives, and Fred's found some clever ways to leverage big businesses who get loan guarantees from XM into helping the credit ratings of smaller businesses in their supply chain. So I think the discussion can be a little more broad-based as we approach the politicians out there. Congressman Reichert, did you have a comment on this? Speaking of which,
Well, I thank you. I still like to think of myself as the sheriff back in Seattle. So did that for 33 years. I just look like I've been here 40 years. Mr. President, my name is Dave Reichert. I'm from Washington State. And, of course, the most trade-dependent state in the country, about one out of every three jobs is connected to trade. And we've been working real hard. I'm on the Ways and Means Committee. I'm on the Trade Subcommittee. And when the Corus Agreement, Columbia Agreement, Panama Agreement was being discussed, we formed a team that we called the Corus Working Group. Very successful in working with then Ambassador Kirk and your administration, and really enjoyed that opportunity. We now have a group that we have organized that hopefully you've heard of. It's called the Friends of TPP. And
it's a great group.
Yes, thank you. Greg Meeks from New York, Ron Kine from Wisconsin, Charles Bastani and myself. Charles from Louisiana, have put this group together, and I just wanted to mention that our relationship with Mr. Froman, Ambassador Froman, has been excellent. Their staff has been excellent. We've been working together hard on TPP, but we all recognize, and this was the first letter discussed this morning, and I'm going to guess that that's because it's one of the most important letters, the importance of TPA. We, as the Friends of TPP, would like to offer our help to you and meet with you. That would be an extra special treat. But staff and Mr. Froman, to see how we can gather and garner more support in Congress on both the Senate side and the House side, we're ready to work with you. The second thing I wanted to mention as far as the access to capital for small business, both the Senate and the House have been working hard on tax extenders, as you know. There is agreement in both the Senate and the House on tax extenders. It's just a disagreement on how long to extend these bills like the built-in gains tax, the R&D tax credit, which we talked about, which I think really lends itself to providing some certainty for our businesses across the country, and I think that's what they're looking for. More than anything. And so, again, we offer our help. Democrats and Republicans sitting at the table today, we offer our help to all of you. I'm a charter member of the group and happy to be here. And it's just an honor and a pleasure to be here with you this morning, sir. And I appreciate the time to make some comments.
Well, I appreciate you, Congressman, for the work you're doing. Obviously, Kirsten and our outstanding Minnesota senator, who we're going to be seeing, Amy. And
I thanked her for Jared Allen earlier. She really believes in exports.
That could be very helpful. I will tell you that the work we're doing around these big trade deals, the work that Mike is doing, is as ambitious as anything that we've done in a very long time. And it's there have been some questions raised about, is now the time for trade? And I think in some cases, issues have surfaced around its impact on environmental standards or labor standards. And what I say to folks who are concerned about these issues is you should get all the facts. You should raise all your questions, but oftentimes people are fighting battles from 20, 25, 30 years ago. The truth of the matter is today, the issue is not whether a company can move to China. If they wanted to move, they could move under the current regime. The question is, can we start getting more companies to come back? Can we raise standards in the Asia-Pacific region? Can we make environmental and labor standards and intellectual property protections strong enough? Because that will advantage our companies. And that's what this trade deal does. It's going to lower some barriers, but a lot of what these trade deals are doing is strengthening standards in such a way that companies that play by the rules and countries that play by the rules are going to benefit, and those who are skirting the rules are going to find that there are stronger enforcement mechanisms in place than there have been in the past. And nowhere is that more true than in something like intellectual property. We just talked about innovation. It's tough to innovate if you know that somebody's going to do a knockoff of your innovation 6 months later and undercut your market. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing on this. It is going to be a bipartisan piece of legislation. I will be happy to meet with friends of TPP. I think it's probably more important for me to meet with the enemies of TPP. But you know, it's always nice to get some encouragement before I go into the lion's den. But obviously we'd benefit from some strategizing, figuring out how we want to frame the issues, what questions other members have heard that they're most concerned about that we can respond to. So with that, I've gotten my cue that I'm going to a meeting that's probably not as fun as this one, but important as well. I just want to say to Jim and Ursula and to everybody on the council, thank you so much for your leadership. We really appreciate it. All right?
Thank you. Thank you.